Hello everyone, it's George from Ireland, so thank you for coming back to my channel. This video is about Winston Churchill's 150th birthday, which is only 2 days ago, because his nativity was the 30th of November, 1874, born in Blenheim Palace, Oxford, or just north of Oxford. I remember reading a book by Roy Jenkins about prime ministers and shows a photograph of Blenheim Palace. And said it was the most magnificent birthplace of any prime minister of the United Kingdom, and that is indisputably true. He was born there because his grandfather was the Duke of Marlborough, and that's been the seat of the dukes since the early 18th century, when Winston Churchill's distant ancestor, Sir John Churchill, was raised to ducal rank and a great for Parliament because of his victories over the French in the Wars of Spanish Succession, and granted this estate and gave him a huge monetary reward, and he was able to build out the only non-royal, non-episcopal palace in the British Isles. Well, actually, there's Scone Palace, but was that royal once? Anyhow, and the trees are there not at random. They're meant to laid out to show the positions of troop formations of the Battle of Blenheim. So named after Sir John Churchill's most resounding victory at Blindheim in Bavaria over the French and Bavarians. But that's another story. Immortalized in After Blenheim, that poem by Robert Southey. So Churchill was born 2 months prematurely, which might explain his rather modest stature and perhaps some of his difficulties with his shoulder often becoming dislocated at times of stress. His mother, Jenny Jerome, she was the daughter of a New York financier. And then his father was Lord Randolph Churchill, the younger son of the then Duke of Marlborough. So the Churchills that actually come from Oxfordshire in the Middle Ages, a minor landing holding family of no great distinction, and so they're named after a village. Churchill in Oxfordshire is not the village that is named after the family, and they shifted west to Wiltshire, and that's where his ancestor was, his six times great-grandfather Sir John had risen to prominence in the English Civil War as a royalist, and eventually did very well under Charles II, and had defeated the Monmouth's rebellion in 1685, fought with James II. His sister was James II's mistress, had 5 children with him, but then turned his coat when William of Orange landed on the 5th of November 1688 at Torbay, and on and on, and was favoured by Queen Anne. His wife was a dear friend of Queen Anne. And then the Churchills never looked back. So Winston, his mother was she 18 when he was born? His parents had met at Cowes Week only about 9 months before. So one thing is, was she pregnant on her wedding day? Just possibly. Although, you know, premarital sex was a real no-no for upper class girls in particular. And it would probably not have been unchaperoned with Lord Randolph Churchill, an up and coming Tory MP. Lord Randolph Churchill, who was has certainly had the bulldog spirit, who'd been to Eton, Merton College, Oxford, eventually rose to be Chancellor Exchequer, was talked about as being Prime Minister, man of vaulting ambition, but who died at the age of, 46, of syphilis. So he's a few years older than his wife. Churchill had one younger brother, Jack, who went into stockbroking. He served in the First World War, but took no part in politics. His daughter, Clarissa, married Sir Anthony Eden. Eden's the one who immediately followed Churchill's Prime Minister. Eden's second wife, Eden was previously married, had 3 sons, divorced. So that Clarissa Churchill, she only died 4 years ago at the age of over 100. I think the second longest Prime Minister's spouse, living spouse, I mean, Mary Wilson, Harold Wilson's wife, she lived even longer. But coming back to Winston, he didn't grow up there, a house in London by Edgware Road, various different houses. So yeah, he was not in line to inherit title of Duke. It went from his grandfather to his uncle, eventually his uncle to his cousins, obviously the Duke of Marlborough down to this day. Is that current nincompoop who was formerly Marquess of Blandford? Is it him? Because that's the courtesy title. The heir to the title of Duke of Marlborough is known as the Marquess of Blandford. And in the 80s and 90s, there was a complete basket case, you know, a drug addict, spendthrift, who had that title. And that's why they managed to put the Marlborough estate into a trust, Blenheim, so that he couldn't spend it all on drugs. So Churchill went to St. George's Ascot, then a boys' prep school, now a girls' secondary school. He was no good at Latin, and he was severely caned for that. His mother was horrified by the harshness of it. You should see that film, Young Winston, about what happened to him, where as a young man, he's memorably played by Anthony Andrews, who later starred in that 1981 television series, Brideshead Revisited. Winston then went to Harrow. His father so loathed Eton that he had a son, Winston, go to Harrow. Winston so detested Harrow, he had his only son, Randolph, go to Eton. Incidentally, in that family, the names go through the generations, Winston, Randolph, Winston, Randolph, Winston, Randolph. I can't remember which one we're on to right now. So Winston Churchill's own son was Randolph and his son was Winston. So there was Winston Churchill was an MP until 1997, the grandson of the Prime Minister. And I remember in Washington, D.C., when he visited one time in the 1980s, there was going to be a talk by Winston Churchill. They thought, what? A seance is coming back from the dead? No, it was the grandson, the more famous one. So our Winston Churchill was Winston Spencer Churchill, is a double barrel surname to begin with. So he was a collateral ancestor of Princess Diana, because there's a family Spencer. But at Harrow School, they had to process in alphabetical order. And Winston Churchill didn't be so like being so far down the alphabet, Spencer Churchill. So he said, drop the Spencer, just go by Churchill. Another thing is, he's often Winston S. Churchill to distinguish him from another Winston Churchill, who was a well-known American novelist in the early 20th century, who was much better known than our Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill. Leonard was a middle name. Well, I won't go through his whole career at Sandhurst and after that. But yeah, he's assailed. He's seen as evil. The BLMers are after him. Some people can't forgive a 19th century man for not having 21st century attitude. So he was a man of his time. People talk about his racialism. Now he's philo-Semitic. So we'll say he wasn't racist in that regard. But he shared, I suppose, the white supremacist assumptions of many 19th century whites. Paternalistic racialism, certainly not violent racialism, not hating people and so on. So when the white world was the most economically, politically, scientifically, technologically masterful in comparison with the non-white world, took it as axiomatic that whites ought to govern non-whites and so forth. It wasn't opposed to interracial marriage and so on. There were some Indians whom he really, really liked. He thought Indian independence would be cataclysmic, would lead to Brahmin rule. Now, of course, in the short term, it was catastrophic with partition. Brahmin rule, well, I suppose Brahmins did tend to dominate, but now there's this caste discrimination. There's a lot of caste violence in Bihar. Now, Indian independence has not been as cataclysmic as he forecast. I mean, certainly recently, India is highly successful. But he'd actually been a bit more liberal on this throughout the First World War as colonial secretary, been willing to agree to some reforms and things like that. So he did some distasteful things. He wasn't anti-gay, though he never advocated for the decriminalization of homosexuality. He had some gay friends. He was once accused of homosexuality in his early 20s, and he successfully pursued a libel action on that one, because, of course, homosexual acts were criminous in England and Wales till 1967, and that would have been jail for him. Quite apart from going to prison, even if he hadn't disproved it, that might have been curtains for his political career. So what else about Churchill? Yeah, a high-functioning alcoholic, suffered from the black dog, manic depressive. But there he could be extraordinarily ebullient and have explosive energy, even in his 70s, as Prime Minister, jumping over walls and things like that. A bit like Pitt the Elder, the Earl of Chatham, another great wartime leader, who also manic depressive. Well, maybe he had this bipolarity. And that's why he could be extraordinarily energetic and inspiring all those around him. Radiating energy, as well as sometimes being down in the dumps, and Churchill not getting out of bed all day. Churchill never got drunk, but then he never got sober, slowly sipping whiskey. He would look askance at one of his habits then of having his secretaries undress him, but he had high moral standards. They had to be over 21, or come into him when he was in the bath. He would dictate to them and he'd see them in the nude and things like that. But extraordinarily witty, a man who was very fecund as a writer, published millions of words. And he was first of all a journalist after his not very distinguished career as an army officer, wrote the Malakand Field Force, A History of the English Speaking Peoples. He wrote a biography of his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough. He went to Germany in 1932 when Hitler was not quite chancellor, and suggested meeting Hitler. They're due to have luncheon, but Hitler had to cancel the last minute, so they never met. Even in great contemporaries in 1937, he effusively praised Adolf Hitler. He'd even addressed a fascist rally in Italy in the early 1920s, saying that Mussolini was a great lawgiver, and if I were Italian, I would be amongst you. Now, admittedly, in the early 1920s, the fascist reputation was nothing like as bad as it later became. And most middle-of-the-road people thought that communism was the mortal peril to civilization, that fascist violence in those days was trifling compared to that of communists. And remember, the fascists in Italy, they didn't establish a dictatorship overnight. They did it step by step. It took about 4 years to be a fully dictatorial state, to really bring in totalitarianism. Yeah, so well known as a magnificent orator. But having said that, having heard some of the recordings, their delivery is less orotund and moving than you might imagine. But yeah, very gifted in crafting his words, and he put a lot of time and effort into it. And his lisp was even an affectation, said it was not displeasing. So yeah, he was certainly a political titan, fixated with foreign affairs, with militaria. But he brought in some economic reform, helped lay the foundation of the welfare state around 1910. He was opposed to female suffrage, so you could say he was purblind on some issues. And someone wrote to him after he retired as prime minister, simply addressed it, the greatest man on earth. No address, no country, the greatest man, and it got to him. So that's him. So just an extraordinary figure, an absolute colossus of the 20th century. And many people say that he saved the world, but as the Greeks would say, had his heroic flaws as well. Well, that is Winston Churchill. And he was offered the title of Duke of London. He declined it, partly because he was a bit sour that he was ever going to get a hereditary title, but thought his name must be enough. And though he had the most splendiferous state funeral, one of the only commoner apart from Lord Nelson to be granted a state funeral, he insisted he'd be buried not in some enormous mausoleum, but in a simple grave at Blenheim Churchyard. Bladen Churchyard, a mile from Blenheim Palace, within sight of Blenheim Palace. And on his grave, it says but one word, Churchill. Because he needs no introduction, buried beside his family, his years of birth and death, and that's it. So well worth visiting. Anyway, Winston Churchill, they don't make him like that anymore. You see how puny, how pusillanimous, how disappointing, how pathetic politicians are today, and what it took to be an orator in those days, with no loudspeaker system, addressing live crowds of thousands, no teleprompter, no audio system or things like that. And it was rowdy, it was ruckus, rambunctious. These were fractious affairs, having to testily suppress hecklers and so forth. And he was a man of immense physical courage, almost suicidally brave. Deliberately exposing himself to enemy fire when he's in the Malakan field force, saying, I'm playing for high stakes and I have more credibility in commanding troops in future if I put my life on the line. So exposing himself to enemy fire when there was no rationale to do so. And he led from the front as a war correspondent in South Africa being captured. Now, he was playing both sides of the street. He could have been executed there. If you're a war correspondent, if you're a journalist, you don't carry a gun. You don't open fire. So you can't have it both ways. Escaping from there, one of the few good pieces of news early in the Second South African War, good bits of news for the United Kingdom. That was Churchill. Right, ladies and gentlemen, so thank you very much for listening to my video. Make sure you subscribe on Patreon, donate to PayPal, georgecallahan79@gmail.com. Goodbye.